It's time to read today from the Sioux City Journal for today, Saturday, June 6th, 2020. I'm John Reef. I'll be selecting the articles and reading the articles today. Here's what we'll do. We'll start with the weather and the mini editorial. Next, we'll move to the front page and read stories there. Then move to the inside pages for stories of local interest. At the 20-minute mark or so, we will go into the opinion page and letters to the editor, if there are any. At the 8:30 mark, we'll do obituaries, followed by more local stories, sports, and other features as time allows, including Dear Abby. Let's start with the weather for today. Partly sunny and increasingly windy. Winds out of the southeast, 12 to 25 miles an hour, and a high today of 88 degrees. Tonight, becoming cloudy, breezy, and humid. Winds still at 12 to 25 and 76 for the low tonight. Tomorrow, even stronger winds out of the south from 20 to 30 miles an hour and warming up, a high of 95 degrees for Sunday. Sunday night's low of 74 degrees and mostly sunny, windy, and hot on Monday, a high of 91, winds still out of the south at 20 to 30 miles per hour. Monday night's low down to 66 and then cooling off a lot on Tuesday and might have a passing morning shower, a high only 71 degrees for Tuesday, so a lot cooler. And the winds northwest 8 to 16 miles per hour. Tuesday night's low of 55 degrees. And on Wednesday, mostly sunny, breezy, and pleasant, a high of 77 degrees. And now for the mini editorial today is from Jim Anderson of Lamar's, and it reads as follows. We have a pandemic virus out of control, high unemployment, racial injustice, lost respect from foreign countries, massive political corruption, and Republican senators without a spine. We are so tired of winning all the time. Again, that from Jim Anderson of Lamar's, Iowa. And the top story in the front page of local interest, West Middle to change principal, according to a consultant advising higher second administrator, increase student supervision. This by Brett Hayward, Dateline Sioux City. The troubled atmosphere at West Middle School could be improved by adding another administrator and increasing supervision in hallways to reduce student scuffles, according to a report from an independent consultant the district hired to look into problems reported by teachers, parents, and others. Those are among the findings in an 8-page summary of the report, which the school board is expected to discuss at its meeting Monday night. The consultant, K-12 Insight, shared the full report with West Middle personnel in May. The district is not releasing to the public confidential sections of the report that might identify personnel or students. Release of the redacted report comes amid reports the district intends to replace Scott Cole, principal of West Middle, during the last school year with Angela Bemis, who has been principal at Leeds Elementary School. Cole will transfer to another position with the district, school board member Dan Greenwell said. I have full confidence that the new principal, Angela Bemis, is the right person to lead the improvement activities, Greenwell told the Journal. Greenwell and board member Taylor Goodvin pushed to have as much information as possible shared with the public. Greenwell said the 8-page summary gives, quoting here, sufficient details for the public to gain clear insight on West Middle. I have reviewed the full report, which contains fairly specific behavioral attributes that should remain confidential, Greenwell said. All board members have access to the full report if they choose to review it. In December, some teachers and other staff began raising concerns about the instructional and disciplinary climate at West Middle at 3301 West 19th Street. Among other concerns, the instructor said, and here's a quote, student behaviors are out of control and contagious, as admins, that is administrators, will no longer discipline, and teachers let things slide because there is no time for all of the documentation. As part of its report, K-12 Insight interviewed roughly 55 West Middle staff members over 3 weeks in April, Superintendent Paul Gossman wrote in a memo to the school board that accompanies the report. K-12 Insight's recommendations include increasing the number of West Middle administrators from 2 to 3. An estimate of how much that would cost the district was not provided. In a section titled Behavior and Discipline, the report says, many staff members made statements regarding issues with student behavior throughout the building. Comments included that students are disruptive in the classroom, making it difficult to deliver instruction. Staff members said that the process for making a behavioral referral is cumbersome and unclear. They praised the dean for the job he was performing, but also believed he is overwhelmed with the number of students in need of intervention. Staff members said it is unclear what happened with students when the dean was not available. Many staff members shared their beliefs and frustration that when they sent students to the office and no one was available to talk to the student, he or she was simply sent back to class. In one other topic that involves classroom management, staff members expressed frustration about the requirement to move to a classroom in one of several pods for one class each day rather than moving students between pods. They said that current practice means pupils arrive in classrooms before teachers. There is no time to retrieve any forgotten items from the other pods, and extra time must be used to rearrange the classroom and reset the technology from how the teacher in the previous period had used the room. With the students arriving before the teacher then needs to spend time refocusing the students after the unstructured time, the report says. Goodman said he's glad the district released the report summary online Friday, saying, quoting here, "All taxpayers, parents, students, and staff members of the district deserve to know that the redacted findings of the report." Still quoting, "I have read the report and have listened to the presentation by K-12, Goodman said. "I was thoroughly impressed with K-12's honest and often highly critical research. I am disappointed with the lack of communication and involvement from downtown administration. I strongly believe better management from downtown administrators would have resolved the issues at West Middle School before getting to this point." Greenwell, who frequently poses concerns about the leadership of Gossman and his cabinet team, said there is too much of administrators doing a walk through buildings without gaining a true understanding of how those schools are functioning. "The key point, in my opinion, is that the layers of downtown senior administration were not in tune or aware of the overall climate, staff morale, or key operational aspects of the school. That is very disappointing," Greenwell said. "Unfortunately, I don't think that only applies to West Middle. We have been hearing similar issues district-wide." On the front page, it has a side note saying you can visit SiouxCityJournal.com to read an 8-page report on West Middle School from consultant K-12 Insight. The next front page story, Siouxland receives NYC donation of PPE. Community Health Center was recipient of masks and gowns. This Dateline Sioux City by Dolly Butts. On Friday morning in Siouxland Community Health Center's parking lot, Ethan Wagner wore a pale blue surgical mask as he stood beside a black SUV. Inside the vehicle's open trunk were cardboard boxes containing numerous face shields, medical-grade masks, and surgical gowns. Wagner noted that a shipment of gloves and surgical masks from Last Mile, #NYCPPE, would also be forthcoming. The organization is part of the greater Last Mile network of volunteers who are focused on getting life-saving personal protective equipment, also known as PPE, to healthcare workers on the front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic. "We are all brothers and sisters, all of us who inhabit the earth for the same brief moment. We have to look out for each other, and we need it to help whoever needs it the most," Wagner said. "When I last saw that Sioux City was so especially hard hit, that's why I wanted to come and focus my efforts here." Last Mile was founded in New York in mid-March as the city and the state grappled with one of the largest COVID-19 outbreaks in the world. Other Last Mile chapters have since sprung up in San Diego, Los Angeles, Boston, Chicago, and New Orleans. As COVID-19 cases began to decline in New York City, Last Mile noted big spikes in positive tests in Sioux City, as well as Gallup, New Mexico. Wagner sought to find out what was behind the surge in cases in Sioux City. He came across a May 9th Sioux City Journal story about Woodbury County's rate of hospitalization for COVID-19 being more than double the national average. He contacted the author of this story, Dolly Butts, who in turn connected him with the health center, which runs a drive-through COVID-19 testing site on its property. "The first time I was in Iowa in my life was last summer for the Iowa State Fair, so I didn't really have an existing network of contacts and friends," Wagner explained. After speaking with health center representatives, Wagner said he learned that Siouxland's Latino and Somali immigrant communities, as well as the Native American population, have been hit particularly hard by the virus. Many of them work in local meatpacking plants, which have experienced outbreaks. Wagner said Last Mile performs a, quoting here, sort of triage with the PPE, making it a point to talk to doctors and nurses in communities, in addition to healthcare administrators, to ensure the supplies are getting into the hands of those who desperately need them. Occasionally, at the beginning, I don't know if it's out of pride or lack of knowledge, but sometimes we were getting different answers if we were talking to hospital administrators and then talking to actual nurses and doctors who work there. Sometimes we're hearing, oh, we're fine, from the top-level management, and hearing from individual workers, we only have one mask for 2 weeks or something like that, he said. On Friday, the health center accepted roughly 1,200 face shields, 1,000 KN95 masks, 200 N95 masks, and 25 surgical gowns from Last Mile. Wagner said the PPE was provided by Mark Albert, a New York-based doctor, and Get Us PPE. Mary Captain Dahlin, the health center's CEO, expressed gratitude for the donation. We are grateful for this unexpected but greatly appreciated donation of PPE. The health center has conducted over 8,200 COVID tests, and this donation will allow us to provide needed testing for so many Siouxland residents, she said. Wagner said Last Mile partners with individual donors, as well as organizations such as A Million Masks and Get Us PPE, to obtain PPE. Then Last Mile's teams distribute it. The macro group typically drops off gloves, face shields, medical masks, and gowns at hospitals and healthcare facilities, while the micro group makes PPE deliveries to individual healthcare workers. Wagner said accessing PPE has been especially tough for those working in nursing homes or elder care facilities that are not connected with hospitals. A lot of the equipment and attention, I think, and the existing supply chains is better at hospitals and health clinics than it is, say, at nursing homes and facilities that weren't having to stock things like N95 masks or head-to-toe hazmat-style gowns before, he said. Wagner said Last Mile plans to expand its program to other essential workers who have to report to work or risk losing their jobs. We're trying to proactively reach out to communities because it protects everyone in the end, he said. In two inset pictures, one of them on page A5, it shows Ethan Wagner of New York City, a volunteer with Last Mile, hashtag NYC PPE, as he delivered boxes of donated personal protective equipment Friday to the Siouxland Community Health Center in Sioux City. Wagner read a news story in the Sioux City Journal about shortages of equipment to protect local health care workers from exposure to the novel coronavirus and reached out to donate the items to the health center. In the other inset picture, a big one on the front page, it shows again Ethan Wagner, a volunteer with Last Mile, hashtag NYC PPE, as he hands a stack of KN95 masks Friday to Melanie Graves, a registered nurse working in the Siouxland Community Health Center's drive-through COVID-19 testing site in Sioux City. Wagner delivered donated boxes of personal protective equipment to the health center after reading a news story in the Sioux City Journal about shortages of equipment to protect local health care workers from exposure to the coronavirus. The next local story, also about COVID-19, new COVID-19 cases slowing in Woodbury County, hospitalizations also declining. This is by Nick Hytrek, Dateline Sioux City. The number of new cases of COVID-19 in Woodbury County appears to be slowing, a trend that has healthcare officials encouraged that the spread of the respiratory illness is flattening in the Sioux City metro area. The number of COVID-19 patients who are hospitalized also has declined, administrators at Sioux City's two hospitals said Friday, leaving room to accept transfers from other communities if needed. The hospitals were caring for a combined 73 patients on Friday, a decrease from a high of 95 on May 26th. It's a decline, and it is flattening over the past week, and it seems to be holding, Beth Hughes, Mercy One Western Iowa Region President, said at a weekly news conference hosted by Woodbury County Emergency Management to update the community on the spread of COVID-19. She said Mercy One Siouxland Health Center in Sioux City had 21 or 22 patients on ventilators as of Friday morning, the hospital can utilize up to 54 beds with ventilators. Unity Point St. Luke's president and CEO Lynn Wold said 11 patients at his hospital were on ventilators Friday because of COVID-19, well under the 40-bed capacity. Siouxland District Health Department Director Kevin Green said the percentage of COVID-19 tests that yielded positive results in Woodbury County dropped to 13% this week from 17% last week. "We are really seeing a leveling off of things that are going on," Green said. On Friday, the health department reported 27 new COVID-19 cases. Across the river in Nebraska, Dakota County reported 12. Both counties frequently had triple-digit daily increases in May as testing was ramped up in the community and at the Tyson Fresh Meats plant in Dakota City. "The slowdown in new cases is cause for optimism," Green said, "but health officials are curious to see results in the coming week. It's been two weeks since many Woodbury County restaurants, hair salons, and other businesses were allowed to reopen. The state allowed bars in the county to reopen beginning May 28th. Graham said testing should show by the end of next week if those reopenings have led to an increase in exposure and new cases among people who have begun spending more time outside their homes. "We are just waiting to see how residents respond and the steps they've taken to continue to protect themselves and others in the community," he said. Green urged people to continue taking precautionary measures such as frequent hand washing, wearing masks over their mouth and nose in public, and avoiding mass gatherings. Hughes said the two hospitals have cared for nearly 400 COVID-19 patients since the first case was reported in Woodbury County on March 27th. "The influx of cases has been stressful at times on the medical staffs," they said, "but both facilities handled the recent spike." "We are not full. We have not been full. We've transferred no patients," Hughes said. Wold said Unity Point had transferred fewer than 10 COVID-19 patients from the hospital. "We've been able to meet the patient demand coming through our doors," Wold said. He and Hughes both said they were able to receive personnel and resources from sister hospitals when staffs at the Sioux City hospitals were stretched thin. Hughes said rumors that the staff at Mercy One was overwhelmed when cases spiked were exaggerations. "At no time was this as dire as people in the community were led to believe," Hughes said. All right, moving now to page A3. Hundreds march from Cook Park to police headquarters Friday. This is by Mason Doctor, Dateline Sioux City. Hundreds of demonstrators marched Friday afternoon from Sioux City's Cook Park to the Sioux City Police Headquarters building and back again in support of racial unity, and a petition seeking body cameras for the Sioux City Police Department is seeking thousands of signatures. It was the second day of an organized, peaceful protest event in Sioux City related to the May 25th police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. The demonstrations on both Thursday and Friday featured input from law enforcement and were organized largely by the same groups. Separate nighttime protests in Sioux City this week have also remained largely peaceful. Organizers seem to encounter a diplomatic messaging style. Deliberate racial antagonism and violence were expressly forbidden at Friday's event. Marchers on Friday carried signs with messages like "End Racist Terror," "Keep the Peace, Reform the Police," "Diversity Siouxland," and "Hands Up, Don't Shoot." En route to the police station, they chanted phrases including "Silence is Compliance," "No Justice, No Peace," and "Black Lives Matter." Vehicles honked as they drove past. The activists have taken the opportunity to press the Sioux City Police Department to adopt body cameras, a practice increasingly common in other departments, which has yet to take hold in Sioux City. Woodbury County Sheriff's deputies began wearing body cameras seven years ago. A pro-body cams petition circulating at Sioux City's protest had garnered an estimated 2,500 signatures to date. Jasmine Preston of Sioux City, who began the petition early this week, said the goal is to reach 20,000 signatures by the end of June. "I would like to have Sioux City be caught up with the rest of the area for body cams," Preston said Friday. She added that the petition drive has taken donations to help the city defray the cost of body cameras. As recently as January, Mayor Bob Scott chastised police officials for their delays in getting cameras on their officers. For 8 of these budget years, you guys have said, we're real close. We've got to get the storage down. We want to make sure we have the right vendor. I understand all that, but after 8 years, it's pretty indicative that you don't really want the cameras. Speaking to the demonstrators Friday, Sioux City Police Chief Rex Mueller reiterated his support for the petition and for body camera technology, which is generally seen as a means of holding officers accountable after incidents of possible misconduct. We all signed to help us get body cameras, to show transparency, to get the things that we want, to show you that there's nothing to hide in law enforcement, Mueller said. Clifton Coleman of Sioux City, who also goes by the name of Cliff J, spoke Friday of two plagues, the race relations and police problem and the coronavirus outbreak. The virus has wreaked havoc on African American communities, with African Americans being hospitalized and dying at higher rates than whites. We're in the midst of a pandemic and in the midst of racism. We have COVID-19 and racism 2020, but I'm going to tell you something, we're still in a good place, Coleman told the crowd. We're still in a good place. We're in a good place because love is alive. We're in a good place because hope is still alive, he added. We're still in a good place, even though we have fallen down, but as long as you can look up, you can get up, and when you get up, you can be able to push forward for change. Dr. Paula Bennett, a Sioux City physician who is Black, said she feels the state of race relations in Sioux City is, quoting here, better than a lot of places, end quote. She recalled only one negative policing experience in which someone called the police on her teenage son while he was sitting in a car near Grandview Park. Besides that, I really think Sioux City's a fair place, Bennett said. It's time now to go to the opinion page, and we have other voices. This is from the Lincoln, Nebraska Journal Star, and it's titled, Proposed Hate Crime Ordinance is a Good Move. In January, a swastika was painted on the front steps of the South Street Temple and anti-Semitic graffiti on the synagogue's wooden front door in Lincoln, Nebraska. Last month, swastikas were discovered spray-painted onto trees in Wilderness Park and on a Holdridge Street bike trail in Lincoln. Those bigoted acts of vandalism and reports of bias against our Asian American residents resulting from false assumptions about coronavirus prompted Lincoln Mayor Laron Gaylor Baird to propose a city ordinance that would create a city hate crime designed to outlaw offenses committed to intimidate. The proposed ordinance would not create a new crime. Rather, it would make the commission of an already prohibited offense an additional crime if the perpetrator meant to intimidate someone based on their actual or perceived race, color, religion, physical or mental disability, national origin, age, ancestry, gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender expression. Violation of the ordinance would be punishable by up to 6 months in jail and a $500 fine, and the sentence would be required to be served consecutively to any other sentence unless a judge stated on the record why it should be concurrent. Spray painting swastikas on a church or temple, for example, could carry a new charge under the ordinance. A 21-year-old Plattsmouth man arrested in February for allegedly spray-painting the swastikas on the South Street Temple has been charged with felony criminal mischief. That vandalism-related charge is the only remedy now available for city prosecutors. The proposed ordinance would provide another tool for prosecutors to work to stop perpetrators of hate. Those crimes, as the Lincoln Journal Star editorial board has previously stated, are not just vandalism against property, intimidating expressions of speech, or isolated attacks on one group of people. Rather, they are assaults on our humanity and the basic principles of our nation that we as individuals and a government are obligated to defend. The charge and punishment proposed aren't likely to serve as a deterrent to hate crime, but just having it on the books alone sends a strong message about what the community stands for, said City Attorney Jeff Kirkpatrick. Indeed, the ordinance, which would be passed after this month's City Council public hearing, would deliver and fortify the message that, in the words of Gaylor Baird, hate has no home in Lincoln and that every resident belongs here. And again, that from the Lincoln, Nebraska Journal Star in the opinion page. Moving now back to page A3, lawsuit against Bertrand Development dismissed. In this Dateline Sioux City, a lawsuit filed by El Coliseo nightclub owners who said construction of the Chestnut Hill development has encroached upon their property has been dismissed. Moises Camberos Arteaga and Jorge Camberos Arteaga also had sought more than $300,000 in cleanup costs, lost market value, and other revenue losses. They said that Chestnut Hill, which is being developed by Sioux City developer Rick Bertrand, has caused. The lawsuit, filed in May 2018 in Woodbury County District Court, was dismissed Monday. There was no settlement agreement, Bertrand said. Bertrand told the Journal in 2018 that the lawsuit, which also named his partner Casey Fenton and Black and Blue Development, a company in which Bertrand and Fenton are partners, was an attempt by the Arteagas to extort them because they could not reach an agreement on a price to sell the El Coliseo property to Bertrand and Fenton. This was a good old-fashioned shakedown, Bertrand said Friday. We held our ground, and at the end of the day, it was dismissed. We feel completely vindicated. Bertrand had filed a counterclaim in which he accused the Arteagas of interference with the developer's contractual relations for marketing and sale of homes within the development. That counterclaim also was dismissed. Sioux City Attorney William Horniber, who represented the Arteagas, did not immediately return messages seeking comment. Work began in 2017 on the 27-acre Chestnut Hill, a former borrow pit near the intersection of 28th Street and Floyd Boulevard. Bertrand and Fenton plan 80 units, a mixture of townhomes and single-family homes, in the development. The development includes construction of cul-de-sacs and Blue Drive, a street running on the north side of El Coliseo, which fronts Floyd Boulevard and is adjacent to the Chestnut Hill development. The Arteagas had said that thousands of cubic yards of dirt had been dumped on the El Coliseo property in order to raise the elevation for construction of Blue Drive. Bertrand said developers had remained in compliance with an agreement they had with the owners to be on El Coliseo property while building the street. Bertrand said the lawsuit has not hampered the project. Several homes have been built and sold, he said, and construction of more homes is scheduled for this year. Bishop Nicholas releases statement on racism and violence. In this Dateline Sioux City, the Reverend R. Walker Nicholas, Bishop of the Diocese of Sioux City, on Friday condemned the persistent evil of racism and said the death of George Floyd is one more example of calling out to God for justice. Nicholas also asked for peace during protests that have resulted from the death of Floyd, who died May 25th while pinned to the ground by a Minneapolis police officer. Prejudice based on race assaults the God-given dignity of the persons against whom it is directed, Nicholas said in a statement. It also corrodes the God-imitating capacity to love freely in the hearts of those in whom it lurks. At the same time, we have to recognize that the violence of recent nights is self-destructive and self-defeating. Nothing is gained by violence, and so much is lost. Both worldly justice and the salvation of souls require us not only to denounce this and every sin, but also regularly to examine our own conscience, to repent of our own faults, and by God's grace to teach and model virtue and justice. Millions of men and women of goodwill, of every race and creed, strive to live with each other every day, without either racism or violence, not only in moments of magnified publicity, such as the many laudable and peaceful protests against racism across the country in recent days, but also, and more importantly, in the ordinary affairs of life. May God give us all the grace to grow in this way of goodness, freedom, and charity. Moving now to page A5, South Sioux City fire ruled accidental. A fire that destroyed a South Sioux City apartment building on Thursday has been ruled accidental. South Sioux City Fire Department Captain Jay Mathis said in a news release Friday that the Nebraska State Fire Marshal's Office continues to investigate the fire of the Arbors Complex, 1008 East 17th Street. Firefighters were dispatched to the building at 2:41 a.m. Thursday, and upon arrival saw heavy smoke and flames coming from the third floor balcony. The fire started in the attic, Mathis had said Thursday. Mathis said the collapse of the third floor forced fire crews to exit the building and attack the fire from the outside with aerial units. Damage to the building and its 24 apartments was defined as extensive, Mathis said, but no occupants or firefighters were injured. Damage estimates are not yet available. Mathis said residents are working with property management and the American Red Cross on housing arrangements. South Sioux City firefighters were assisted by crews from Sioux City, Dakota City, and Homer. It's time now to read the obituaries, starting with Sioux City. Carl E. Berndt, that's B-E-R-N-D-T. Carl E. Berndt, 71 years old of Sioux City, passed away Wednesday, June 3rd, surrounded by his family. Services will be 10 a.m. Monday at Waterbury Funeral Service of Orange City at 4125 Orleans Avenue. At Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City, 4125 Orleans Avenue. Burial will be in Grant Township Cemetery in Rodney, Iowa. Visitation will be 5 to 7 p.m. Sunday at the funeral home. We will be following the federal guidelines for COVID-19. Carl Edward Berndt was born on May 12, 1949, the son of Carl and Marie Fertig Berndt. He enlisted in the U.S. Army and served two tours in Vietnam. He was a combat veteran. Carl worked for an industrial painting company for 18 years. He then worked for the city of Sioux City in the Parks and Recreation Department, retiring in 2009. He enjoyed fishing, riding motorcycles, and working on old cars. From Sioux City, James L. Grant Sr., 61 years old of Sioux City, passed away on June 2nd. Native American services will begin Saturday morning at the home of Joyce Grant. Burial will be in Omaha Tribal Cemetery in Macy, Nebraska. Arrangements are under the direction of Munderlow Smith Funeral Home in Pender. James was born on May 21, 1959. His biggest passions were golf and softball. In golf, he loved the outdoors and the challenges of the game. In softball, he was considered one of the kings in every league. He was an All-American in all athletic sports. From Sioux City, Dennis Hansen, 24 years old, died Friday, June 5th. Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City is handling the arrangements. From Sioux City, Garneth Oosteninck, that's O-O-S-T-E-N-I-N-K, 96 years old of Sioux City, passed away Thursday, June 4th at Sunrise Retirement Community. Graveside services will be 11 a.m. Monday in Hope Cemetery of Hull, Iowa. Visitation will be 2 to 4 p.m. Sunday at Morningside Chapel, Christie Smith Funeral Homes, 1801 Morningside Avenue. Ms. Oosteninck was born on August 16, 1923 in Hull, the daughter of Garrett and Hattie Rickers Oosteninck. She attended Hull Christian Grammar School and Hull Public High School. Garneth graduated from Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and received a master's degree in social work from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. Before entering college, she worked as a secretary bookkeeper at Cooker Manufacturing Company in Hull. When she witnessed her sister Lorraine's graduation from Calvin, she decided that she wanted a college degree also, so she entered college at the age of 33. Her post-university positions were in social work in Michigan and 19 years of social work with Western Hills Education Agency in Sioux City. She and her sister Lorraine lived together most of their lives and were best friends. They moved together to Sioux City in 1969 to be near to their aging parents who still lived in Hull. In 2007, they moved to Sunrise Retirement Community where they enjoyed their retirement years. Garneth had been a longtime member of Morningside Reformed Sunnybrook Community Church, where she sang in the choir and was involved in church activities and volunteer work. Past memberships in both professional and civic organizations included local, state, and National Association of Social Workers, the ARC organization, retired school personnel, St. Luke's Hospital Auxiliary, and the Sioux City Women's Club. The family has requested that memorials be directed to the Sunnybrook Community Church or Sunrise Retirement Community. From Sioux City, Carol J. Bahney, that's B-A-H-N-E-Y, 82 years old, passed away Thursday, June 4th. Service will be June 10th, 10:30 a.m. at Morningside Chapel, Christie Smith Funeral Homes. Burial will be at Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation will be June 9th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home. From Ida Grove, Orin C. Rasmussen, 83 years old, passed away Friday, June 5th. Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City is handling the arrangements. From Waldo, Wisconsin, and formerly Smithland, Iowa, Gary E. Service, S-E-R-V-I-S, Gary E. Papa Service, 76 years old, formerly of Smithland, peacefully entered eternal life on May 31st at his home surrounded by family. Private services with the immediate family will be arranged. Public memorial services will be scheduled at a later date due to the COVID-19 risk and social distancing. Arrangements are under the direction of Suchun Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Plymouth, Wisconsin. For online condolences, please visit www.suchonfh.com. Gary was born in Sioux City on October 8, 1943. He was raised in Smithland. He was married to Meredith A. Vine on December 20th in 1975. They started their life together in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. They later retired to Waldo, Wisconsin, where they enjoyed the quieter life of a small community similar to where Gary grew up in Smithland. Gary served 2 years in the U.S. Army during the Vietnam War in Fort Carson, Colorado. He worked many years as an auto insurance adjuster with various automobile insurance companies. He loved his pastime job in retirement with the Pizza Hut Corporation Delivery Division. He was an avid fisherman. When not working, he was on one of many lakes enjoying his favorite hobby, throwing a line to give his wife a good fish story. He was a member of the Order of the Masons in Milwaukee, the American Legion in Smithland, and enjoyed singing in barbershop quartets. He never missed watching his favorite football team, the Green Bay Packers. They raised two beautiful daughters together during their 45 years of marriage, Monica Ann Watkins of Glendale and Carrie Lynn Shubring of Mount Pleasant. The family would like to thank immensely the St. Nicholas Hospice team in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. He gave with all his heart until his heart could no longer give. And the final obituary for the day from formerly Cherokee, Iowa, James Jim Cates Jr., that's C-A-T-E-S, 68 years old. Mr. Cates died Sunday, May 31st. Memorial service will be June 8th at 10:30 a.m. at Boothby Funeral Home in Cherokee. Burial will be in Oak Hill Cemetery with military rites. Visitation will be June 7th from 1 to 5 p.m. at the funeral home. All right, back to some local stories from page 85. Sioux Center chiropractors pay $30,000 to settle false claims allegations. The operators of a Sioux Center chiropractic clinic have agreed to pay $30,418 to resolve allegations that they filed false Medicaid claims. Sioux Center Chiropractic Wellness Center, operated by Tyler and Tiffany Armstrong, had been accused of violating the Federal False Claims Act by billing Medicaid for conditions including constipation and ear infection, for which payment is not allowed. According to the U.S. Attorney's Office, the settlement agreement resolves allegations related to the treatment of Medicaid beneficiaries 7 and under from April 2014 to July 2019. There was no admission or judicial determination of liability. Iowa's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit led the investigation into the allegations. From Lamar's, man pleads not guilty in shooting. A Merrill, Iowa man has pleaded not guilty of fatally shooting another man with a shotgun. Thomas Knapp, K-N-A-P-P, 82 years old, entered his written plea Friday in Plymouth County District Court to charges of willful injury causing bodily injury, domestic abuse assault while using or displaying a dangerous weapon, and two counts of first offense, domestic abuse assault. Willful injury is a Class D felony that carries a 5-year prison sentence. The other charges are misdemeanors. Knapp is accused of shooting Kevin Juzek, 51, of Merrill in the abdomen and chest during a domestic disturbance May 11th in a home in the 20,000 block of Echo Road in rural Merrill. According to court documents, authorities received a 911 call from a woman stating that Knapp, her husband, was assaulting her and her son with a stick and also pointed the shotgun at her. All three people lived at the home, authorities have said. Knapp's charges all pertain to actions toward his wife. Court documents say that Knapp struck his wife in the head and hand with a stick, breaking bones in her hand. Body of person found in Missouri River in Sioux City has been identified. Sioux City law enforcement officials have identified the person whose body was recovered from the Missouri River, but are not releasing the name until family members are contacted. Police Department Sergeant Jeremy J. McClure on Friday said the notification of family is expected within 1 day. On Thursday afternoon, three pedestrians were walking alongside the Missouri River near its confluence with Perry Creek when they saw the body and called police. Around 3 p.m., a rescue boat docked at the Sioux City Marina. First responders held white sheets to conceal the body as it was taken from the boat to a waiting ambulance. The body was taken to the medical examiner's office. Police at the scene couldn't say with certainty how long the body had been in the water. Driver hits pole after being shot at. Sioux City police are investigating a shooting incident that reportedly caused a driver to collide with a utility pole. The Sioux City Police Department, in a Friday release, said the report of a shooting in the 2300 block of Clark Street came in just before 8 a.m. Sergeant Jeremy McClure said responding officers located a car that had struck a pole after being fired upon by another subject. Officers near the scene pursued a male suspect on foot before he eluded them. McClure said the officers have identified the suspect and are currently searching for him. As police continue the investigation, McClure said the person who drove into the pole is providing limited cooperation. He said the driver, who was the only occupant in the car, was not struck in the shooting and reported minor injuries from the wreck. Moving into some sports, NAIA sets some guidelines. While the National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics, known as the NAIA, of course, originally set July 1st as the date it would announce the plans for the fall, the organization met a little earlier and approved some plans this past week. Before I continue, I need to point out that the Great Plains Athletic Conference sent out a tweet Thursday night in reference to the NAIA's decisions. In the tweet, the GPAC said it is finalizing its return to play protocols and will release more information next week. The league will use the NAIA's information in the discussions, but the GPAC will make final decisions as a league for the fall of 2020. So it won't be long until we find out the direction the GPAC will go in with the fall 2020 season for all of its sports. Probably the biggest footnotes that were taken out of the NAIA's guidelines were when athletics could return. All sports can begin practices on August 15th. The plan prohibits programs from practicing on all dates between June 4th and August 14th. It also prohibits preseason scrimmages against outside competition. The guidelines do allow individual conditioning activities to continue on campus through August 14th based on what the rules each institution or conference has set forth. Then every sport except for football can have their first competition on September 5th. The first games for football teams are planned for September 12th. Football, women's volleyball, men's and women's soccer, and cross country are the sports affected, and most of those all have contests before the September 5th and September 12th dates. It basically means programs will play fewer games this season. The maximum contests allowed were reduced in all six sports. Football goes down from 11 games to 9. Volleyball was reduced from 28 dates to 22. Soccer for both men and women goes from 18 to 14 matches. Cross country only lost one meet, going from 8 to 7. For football, it means teams in the GPAC won't have any non-conference games at the moment, since the league has 9 conference games for each program every year. For example, Morningside presumably loses a road trip to Ottawa University, a team that qualified for the playoffs. That game was scheduled for September 5th and was the only non-conference game on the Morningside Mustang schedule. Morningside's second game of the season is currently scheduled for September 12th and is a GPAC contest at home against Northwestern. That was also scheduled to be Northwestern's second game of the season, with the season opener against a presentation on August 25th and now 29th that now presumably canceled. Briarcliff had 2 non-conference games on its schedule, a home date against Waldorf on August 27th and a road game at Dakota State on September 3rd. Dort's schedule on its website already only lists 9 games, all GPAC contests. If the GPAC does keep its original conference schedules, all 4 area GPAC schools still should have an open date on their roster, so they won't play 9 weeks straight of football. Volleyball and men's and women's soccer will presumably lose non-conference games instead of trimming from its conference schedule. The good news for the GPAC programs and all of the sports is the league is competitive enough that the loss of non-conference events won't be a huge hit. Schools will lose gate revenue from 1, if any, non-conference football games, but competitively, the GPAC is one of the toughest leagues in football and volleyball, meaning teams should be ready for the postseason, even with just playing each other in the league. Some programs don't have 8 cross-country meets on their schedule, so the start date will be what affects the programs the most. Besides the start dates and the maximum contests allowed, the third thing the NAIA voted on was the return to play threshold. The threshold goal is for about half of the participating institutions in each sport to receive clearance from local authorities to return to competition before the season can begin. For example, NAIA football has 95 participating institutions. When half, that's 47 of those programs, gain clearance from authorities to play, the NAIA football season will be authorized to begin. Still, there are plenty of things up in the air. Will enough schools authorize athletics, which is what the return to play threshold is dependent on? Will the curve not only flatten but also dip down to make things safe again? Will there be fans in the stands? Some questions may be answered next week, and it will be interesting to see what the GPAC's guidelines will be when they are announced next week. Basically, it's a fluid situation yet, but it seems things are slowly trending in the right direction for sports to return. And again, that's from Justin Rust. It does have an inset picture on the front page of the sports regarding this article, showing Morningside's Arnajay A.P. Ponder pushing through the Red Raider players as Northwestern's Tanner Marichek brings them down in a game in Orange City, Iowa on Saturday, November 16, 2019. The two teams could open the 2020 season against each other due to the guidelines the NAIA approved earlier this week. Another sports story of somewhat local regional interest. Kearney native Roseberry hangs up the cleats. This out of Nebraska baseball by Chris Besnett. Ty Roseberry's summer will revolve around dirt roads and cornfields, the beginning of what he hopes is a long career in the agricultural industry. What there won't be is regret in stepping away from the sport he's made a career of in the first part of his life. At the end of a college journey like no other, Roseberry, a Kearney native, announced May 7th he was stepping away from baseball. As one of six Husker seniors given a redo on their final years after COVID-19 canceled the season, Roseberry could have returned. But after taking about 2 months to think it over, he decided to move on. It was one of those things that I wanted to take time to make sure I was doing what I for sure wanted to do, Roseberry explained. And it was almost 2 months since baseball had been cut for the year, and I wasn't all the way there in my mind. Through multiple conversations with head coach Will Bolt and assistants Lance Harvell and Danny Marcuso in the weeks after the college baseball season was canceled in mid-March, the decision became more clear in Roseberry's mind. It was one of those things where I got to the point where I still hadn't fully wanted to play, so I just decided then that it was time for me to be done, he said. It wasn't for a lack of love for the game. Roseberry had been a standout since his Little League days on Kearney teams that won state titles and competed in regional tournaments. He was one of the top players in Kearney's vaunted Legion system as he went through high school. And he was a budding star at the University of Nebraska Kearney in college, slugging 15 home runs and hitting .340 as a sophomore in 2018. But the Lopers saw their program cut after that season as the athletic department tried to trim its budget. It was a staggering blow for a proud group. Roseberry was ready to play for years for his hometown school. Then he had to find something new. He did in Lincoln, then played one season with the Huskers before seeing the second year taken away from him. I've said this many times, I feel like one big thing in life and baseball I learned from my dad, my mom, my coaches, is life happens. You can't control everything, but the things you can, you definitely want to do that and work your hardest, Roseberry said. Obviously, my path was a little different than most college kids, but I would say to any young guys, anyone that is aspiring to play college baseball, you've got to work hard. Nothing's really given for free. Roseberry hit .211 for NU this season, starting the first 10 games of the year at first base, and he quietly battled injuries through most of Nebraska's abbreviated campaign. Those injuries have lingered to the point that he will have an ankle examined when he returns to Lincoln in the fall for classes to make sure there isn't severe damage. Roseberry is one semester away from graduating with a degree in agricultural economics. This summer, he's doing an internship with Nutrien Ag Solutions, an agricultural retailer in Kearney. He spent the first weeks of that internship learning the ropes and checking in with area farmers as they get their crops in the ground. The plan for a future is beginning to come together, and the realization that baseball is done has solidified as well. Those first few days after the decision were tough. I've been playing baseball my whole life, and I was playing at a place I loved to play, Roseberry said. Since then, I started my internship, and I felt good about my decision. I know that I made the right one. Roseberry said Nebraska's coaches have told him he's welcome anytime he wants to stop by. He's already worked on improving his golf game, something he hasn't had much time for in previous years, and he's ready to spend the near future in the Kearney areas as he gets his school debts paid off and establishes himself in his field. I'm happy, he said. Who knows, if I would have went somewhere else, how it would have turned out. But I liked where I was, met a lot of lifelong friends along the way, and got to play college baseball for 4 years. So I'm glad with how it turned out. On the front page, it shows a picture of Nebraska's Ty Roseberry sitting in the Huskers' dugout before the game against Creighton and Haymarket Park in 2019. It's time now for Dear Abby, and the first article is first letters from Experienced Mom, and the title is Mom Fears History Will Repeat for Daughter Marrying Young. Dear Abby, I have been divorced for 18 years. The main reason for my divorce was that I was married. I married too young and wasn't ready to be a wife and mother. My daughter has just announced her engagement to a truly wonderful man, but she's only 19. I want to support her, but I'm afraid she's making the same mistake I did. I have tried talking to her about it, but she is sure she is making the right decision. I am tight on money now, and I don't want to pay for an expensive wedding if it's going to be a waste later on if my daughter gets a divorce. But I do want to be by her side and support her during one of the most important times of her life. What should I do? Signed, Experienced Mom. Dear Mom, your daughter already knows you're concerned about her marrying so young and the reasons why. Ultimately, this is her decision, or mistake, to make. Explain that you won't be able to contribute financially to her wedding because money is tight right now, but that you are there to support her emotionally now and forever. Tell her, too, that many successful marriages begin at courthouse, and you wish her better luck than you had. The next letter is signed Propositioned in the Midwest. It reads, Dear Abby, my wife of 38 years passed away a year and a half ago. My ex-wife, to whom I was married for 14 years and who is the mother of our adult kids, is single again after 4 failed marriages. She's making overtures about getting together again. She is assertive, likes to spend, and was very jealous. At my age, I could use the help, but it would require selling my house and moving several states away. She's really pushing, but I'm just not sure. It would be nice to have someone around because I am lonely. She is a neat lady, but I just don't know. Help! Signed, Propositioned in the Midwest. Dear Propositioned, surely you can find someone to fill your loneliness other than a woman you divorced for at least 2 solid reasons. I have 4 words of advice for you. When in doubt, don't. Your common sense is fueling your ambivalence. Please pay attention to it. At most, maintain a long-distance friendship with her. And last letter is from Concerned Shopper, and it reads, Dear Abby, during a recent trip to the supermarket, I noticed a couple in their 50s who were shopping for produce. The woman picked up 8 different avocados before selecting one. I counted. The man touched 3 different bags of oranges before placing one in their cart. This was repeated with each item they shopped for. I considered asking them to stop touching the food, but I didn't want a confrontation. How would you have handled this? Can you please encourage your readers to minimize what they touch for the sake of public safety? Signed, Concerned Shopper. Dear Concern, I would have handled it by talking about it to the store manager. In California, signs are posted asking customers to please handle merchandise as little as possible, and shoppers are encouraged not only to wear masks and practice social distancing while shopping for groceries, but also to wear gloves. Once you bring your groceries home, you should wipe them down and always wash your hands thoroughly for the recommended 20 seconds. All right, let's take one last look at the weather for today. Partly sunny and increasingly windy. Southeast winds at 12 to 25 miles per hour. A high today of 88 degrees. Becoming cloudy, breezy, and humid tonight. Winds south-southeast 12 to 25 miles an hour again. 76 for the low tonight. Tomorrow, more windy. Winds becoming strong. Winds south 20 to 30 miles an hour. A high of 95 degrees for Sunday. 74 for the low on Sunday night. Monday, mostly sunny, windy, and hot. Again, a high of 91 degrees and wind south 20 to 30 miles per hour. Monday night's low of 66 degrees. And Tuesday, cooler, a passing morning shower, and 71 degrees. Just 71 for the high on Tuesday. Winds northwest 8 to 16 miles an hour. Tuesday night's low of 55 degrees. And on Wednesday, mostly sunny, breezy, and pleasant, 77 degrees for the high on Wednesday. And that concludes the reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Saturday, June 6, 2020. For the last hour, these stories have been read and selected by me, John Reef. All material on IRIS is intended for the blind and print handicapped. If you have any questions, you can call IRIS toll-free at 800-404-4747. Thank you for listening to IRIS, the radio reading service.